A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's latest prompt starts from a place I find uncomfortable. He flew on a wet lease carrier recently, and somewhere over the Atlantic it hit him that the person flying the Airbus he was sitting in might be 26 years old. Not because anything went wrong, just because the whole point of those operators is that captains get wide-body hours early, before the legacy seniority ladder would let them near the left seat. And he asked the question that follows from that. If a 20-something can land an A330 perfectly well, what exactly is the seniority system for? What develops over decades of flying if it isn't the physical handling of the aircraft? He wants to know what the less visible attributes are, the things that explain why we all picture the gray-haired captain and feel better for it.
The image is doing real work there. The gray-haired captain isn't a technical requirement, he's a comfort object. And I don't mean that dismissively.
You mean the passenger's mental model of safety as a person attached to it?
Right. The passenger can't inspect the maintenance logs or the dispatch release. They can't audit the crew's training records, so they look for a proxy. Gray hair, four stripes, a calm voice on the PA, that's the proxy for something they can't see.
And Daniel's question is whether the proxy corresponds to anything real. If the 26-year-old can fly the plane, the proxy is just theater.
That's the paradox. The physical act of flying a modern airliner is largely identical at 500 hours and 15,000 hours. The automation flies the same profile, the same maneuvers get flown, the same landing gets made. The autopilot doesn't care how old you are. So if the industry is paying for something with seniority, it's not paying for stick and rudder skill. It's paying for something that's invisible in a normal flight.
Which is convenient, because normal flights are almost all of them.
Almost all. And that's the trap. The value of experience is invisible precisely because when it's working, nothing happens. You can't see the near miss that didn't occur. You can't see the decision to divert that prevented an encounter with weather. The flight just lands on time and everyone walks off and nobody thinks about it.
So the question becomes, what does operational experience actually buy if not the ability to handle the aircraft? And I think we have to go into how experts actually think to get at it.
Gary Klein spent decades on this. He studied firefighters, neonatal ICU nurses, military commanders, people who make high-stakes decisions under time pressure. And what he found is that experts don't compare options. They don't sit there and weigh alternatives. They recognize a pattern and run the first workable response. He called it recognition-primed decision-making.
Which is a fancy way of saying they've seen this before, even if they've never seen exactly this before.
That's the key. The situation doesn't have to be identical. The expert recognizes the shape of it. The fire ground commander who says this feels like the time things went wrong and pulls his crew out 30 seconds before the floor collapses. He's not comparing evacuation to stain. He's matching the current situation to a library of prior cases and finding the one that ended badly.
And that library is the thing that accumulates, not motor skill. Not the physical ability to flare the aircraft at the right height. A library of near misses, anomalies, degraded situations, weird radio calls, strange vibrations. The one time the weather did something the forecast said it wouldn't.
Klein studied this in neonatal intensive care nurses too. The experienced nurse looks at a baby and knows it's getting sick hours before the vitals change. She can't articulate exactly how she knows. She just recognizes the pattern. The junior nurse is waiting for the numbers to cross a threshold. The senior nurse is already acting.
That's the difference between a checklist-driven response and an immediate situational read. Both might reach the same action. The junior pilot runs the checklist and gets to the same place the senior captain got to in 5 seconds. But the senior got there faster, and more importantly, he still has cognitive reserve left over for the thing that isn't in the checklist.
The thing that isn't in any manual. That's what actually accumulates, not the procedures, because those are written down and anyone can learn them. The residue of all the situations that didn't make it into the manual because they were too weird, too specific, too messy to generalize.
and the 26-year-old can land the A-30-30. Daniel's right about that. The question is whether the 26-year-old can handle the engine failure at V1 on a contaminated runway in foreign airspace with a fatigued crew and a cabin full of panicking passengers and a warning light that's lying to him.
And that's the scenario that never happens in a simulator. Simulator emergencies are clean. The instructor says engine fire, and you know it's coming, and the cues are unambiguous, and there's one right answer. Real emergencies are messy. The cues are ambiguous. There are competing priorities. You don't know if the vibration is the engine or the cargo shifting. You don't know if the warning is real or a sensor fault. You have incomplete information and you have to act anyway.
The simulator gives you the procedure. It doesn't give you the judgment to know when the procedure is wrong.
And that's where the library of prior cases matters. The pilot who's had a real dual engine failure at altitude has something the simulator trained pilot doesn't, not better hands. A better sense of what the situation actually is. Which warnings to trust and which to ignore. How the aircraft actually behaves when things are falling apart.
Qantas Flight 32 is the case that keeps coming back to me. The A380 that had an uncontained engine failure out of Singapore in 2010. The crew was dealing with dozens of cascading warnings. The aircraft was telling them all kinds of contradictory things. And the value of the crew wasn't in flying the damaged aircraft. It was in knowing which of those warnings were real and which were noise.
Richard de Crespigny was the captain, something like 54 messages, and the crew had to sort through them in real time while managing the aircraft. The automation was generating warnings faster than they could read them. And the experience wasn't in the stick work, it was in the triage. Knowing that this warning matters and this one is a symptom of a symptom and this one can wait.
A junior pilot with the same technical training could have flown the aircraft. That's the thing. The flying wasn't the hard part. The hard part was deciding what the aircraft was actually doing and what to do about it, while the automation was actively misleading them.
And that's the less visible factor Daniel's asking about. Threat anticipation. The Swiss cheese model. Senior pilots don't just react to problems, they preemptively identify where the system might fail and build margins before the problem arrives.
The Swiss cheese model is reasons, right? The idea that accidents happen when the holes in multiple layers line up.
James Reason, yes. And the experienced pilot's job is to notice when the holes are starting to line up and do something about it before they do. That's not in any procedure. That's a mental model of the whole system and where it's vulnerable.
So the senior pilot sees the weather picture doesn't match the forecast and starts building margins. Diverts early. Holds more fuel. Doesn't accept the routing that puts them at the edge of their fuel reserves. The junior pilot follows the plan because the plan is legal.
And the plan is legal right up until it isn't. That's the thing about systemic judgment. The rules are written for normal conditions. The experienced pilot knows when the conditions have stopped being normal.
That's the meta skill. Knowing which rules to break and when. Not breaking them casually, but knowing when the procedure is going to kill you if you follow it.
The automation is lying to you. That's a real thing. The sensors are iced over, the airspeed is wrong, the automation is doing something you didn't ask it to do. The junior pilot trusts the instruments because that's what he was trained to do. The senior pilot has been lied to before and knows the difference.
And the wet lease angle makes this sharper. A young captain on a wet lease operation hasn't seen the rare compounding failures, the ones that only appear once in a career. The institutional knowledge that lives in senior pilots' heads and never gets written down.
Because it can't be written down. That's the thing. The knowledge is too specific, too contextual, too tied to particular situations that will never recur exactly. You can write down the procedure for an engine failure. You can't write down the judgment for when the engine failure is the least of your problems.
So, where does that leave the seniority system? Daniel's asking if it's outdated, and I think the honest answer is that it's partly rational and partly a cultural artifact.
The research on accident rates by experience level shows diminishing returns. The safety curve flattens. There's a threshold where more hours stop predicting fewer accidents, and that complicates the pure seniority argument.
So the line isn't at 15,000 hours. It's somewhere lower. And the difference between a pilot with 5,000 hours and one with 15,000 might be real but small. While the difference between 500 and 5,000 is enormous.
That's the shape of it. The first few thousand hours buy you most of the safety benefit. After that, you're paying for marginal improvements in judgment that only matter in the rarest situations.
Which is a hard thing to sell to a passenger. The marginal improvement only matters in the one flight in a million that goes wrong. But on that flight, it matters completely.
And that's the uncomfortable truth. The seniority system is a blunt instrument. It's a proxy for something it can't actually measure. It certifies time served, not judgment acquired.
But the type rating system isn't outdated. That's the thing. It certifies technical competence. The type rating says you can fly this aircraft. The seniority system is the industry's attempt to certify something harder to measure. Contextual judgment under degraded conditions.
And the industry doesn't have a better proxy. That's the problem. We can measure hours. We can measure checkride performance. We can measure simulator scores. We can't measure judgment. So we use hours as a stand-in and hope it correlates.
And it does correlate, imperfectly. A pilot with 15,000 hours has, on average, seen more than a pilot with 5,000. But the average hides the variance. Some pilots get 15,000 hours of the same flight over and over. Others get 5,000 hours of weird, varied, challenging flying.
The quality and variety of experiences matter more than the raw count. That's a real finding. Not all hours are equal. An hour of hand flying in marginal weather teaches more than an hour of autopilot cruising at altitude.
Which is why the wet lease gambit is actually interesting. The young captain on a wet lease carrier is getting variety. New airports, new airspace, new weather, new operational cultures. That's not nothing. It's not the same as 20 years of experience. But it's not nothing.
And that's the nuance Daniel's question deserves. The wet lease captain isn't a fraud. He's getting experience faster, but he's getting a particular kind of experience. Operational variety. What he isn't getting is the rare compounding failures, because those only happen once a decade.
You can't accelerate the passage of time. That's the thing. You can't accelerate the accumulation of hours. You can't accelerate the accumulation of the one-in-a-career events, because they're rare by definition.
The passenger's trust in the gray-haired captain isn't about the landing. That's the line I keep coming back to. It's about the 9,999 previous flights where nothing went wrong because someone saw the problem coming before it arrived.
The landings that never happened. That's the invisible product. The gray-haired captain's value isn't in the landing, you see. It's in the 1,000 landings that never happened because he diverted, or held, or said no to a dispatch release.
The 26-year-old can do the landing. Daniel's right about that. The question is whether he can do the 1,000 invisible things that prevent the landing from ever becoming necessary.
There's a clinical parallel here. You'd know this better than I would.
The pediatrician who's seen 10,000 ear infections doesn't have better hands than the resident. She has a better sense of which ear infection is actually meningitis. Same physical exam, different pattern recognition. The resident follows the protocol. The attending recognizes the shape of the thing.
The parent in the waiting room can't see the difference. They just know they feel better when the gray-haired doctor walks in.
They're not wrong to feel better. The difference is real. It's just not visible in the routine cases.
What does the industry do with this? If the seniority system is a blunt instrument for measuring something subtle, what's the alternative?
That's the open question. We don't have a good answer. The type rating certifies technical competence. The seniority system proxies for judgment. Neither one actually measures the thing we care about.
The passenger is left with the gray hair as a comfort object, knowing it's a proxy, not knowing if it's a good one.
The thing is, the system does informally recognize judgment. It just doesn't do it formally. The formal system says seniority. The informal system, the schedulers, the chief pilots, the training captains, they know who the good pilots are. They route the tricky flights to the pilots who've demonstrated judgment. That's not in any manual.
The system already knows the seniority ladder is incomplete. It just can't say so.
Because saying so would mean admitting that some pilots with fewer hours are better than some pilots with more. And that's a hard thing to formalize without litigation.
The quiet whitelist. The informal recognition of judgment that can be measured but is absolutely real.
18 months I did dispatch for a cargo outfit. Late 90s, the schedulers had a whitelist. Captains they'd route through the marginal weather airports, the tight curfew slots, the places where the approach was always ugly. And it wasn't the most senior guys on it.
What was the criterion?
Who'd called in once and said, that approach looks wrong in these conditions, let's divert. And been right. That was the whole thing. You got on the list by being the person who said no and turned out to be correct.
The schedulers were already measuring judgment, just informally.
They didn't call it judgment. They called it, he's got a feel for it, or she's got a feel for it. One of the best on the list was a woman in her early 30s, barely 4,000 hours. The schedulers trusted her over men with 3 times her time.
Because she demonstrated the one thing hours can't guarantee.
The willingness to be the unpopular person who says no. That's what the whitelist was. The ones who'd inconvenience everyone and be right about it.
That's the thing the seniority system can't capture. The formal system says 4,000 hours is less than 12,000. The informal system says this person has the judgment we need on the hard routes.
The schedulers never wrote it down. Too much trouble. But everyone knew. You wanted the whitelist captain on the ADIC run in February. You didn't care how many hours they had.
The system knows the proxy is a proxy. It just can't say so out loud.
The airline's gone now, folded in 02. But the whitelist outlived the formal seniority list. People remembered who to call.
That's the wrinkle. The formal system pretends seniority is the measure. The informal system has already figured out it isn't.
The dispatchers were the ones who knew. They saw which captains brought the plane back in one piece when the weather lied. They didn't need the flight hours. They needed the judgment.
The passenger never sees any of this. They see the gray hair and feel better, and the white list captain is 32 and looks like she just graduated.
The gray hair is a costume. The judgment is the real thing, and the two don't always come in the same package.
That's the honest version of Daniel's question. The seniority system isn't outdated because it's wrong about experience mattering. It's outdated because it assumes experience and judgment are the same thing.
They're correlated, but they're not identical. The whitelist captain proves that.
4,000 hours of the right kind beats 15,000 of the wrong kind. The schedulers knew it. The formal system couldn't admit it.
Where does that leave the passenger? If the proxy is imperfect and the real measure is invisible, what do you trust?
You trust the system imperfectly. The type rating says the pilot can fly the plane. The seniority system says the pilot has probably seen more than the alternative. The whitelist says the pilot has demonstrated judgment. None of it's perfect. All of it's better than nothing.
The gray hair is the visible part of an invisible process. It's not nothing. It's just not the thing itself.
The thing itself is the library of prior cases, the recognition prime decision-making, the threat anticipation, the willingness to say no. None of that's visible from C-22A.
That's the vulnerability Daniel's talking about. You put your life in the hands of someone you'll never meet, and you trust them entirely, and you have no way of knowing if they're on the white list or just have gray hair.
The passenger's trust is an act of faith in a system they can't inspect. And the system is better than it looks, but not as good as the gray hair suggests.
The one thing I take from this is that the landing was never the point. The gray-haired captain's value isn't in the 100 landings you see. It's in the 1,000 landings that never happened, because he saw the problem coming before it arrived. The 26-year-old can land the plane. The question is whether he can see the problem coming.
The industry's formal answer to that question is ours. The informal answer is the whitelist. The real answer is that judgment develops unevenly, and we're still trying to figure out how to measure it.
The open question is what a better system would look like. If we could measure judgment directly, would passengers accept it? Or would they still want the gray hair?
As automation reshapes the cockpit, the value of human pattern recognition might shift. Or it might become more valuable precisely because it's rare. The pilots who can see the problem coming are the ones the automation can't replace.
The landing is the easy part. The seeing is the hard part. And that's what decades of flying actually buys.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing this episode.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed it, leave us a review wherever you listen.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.